In the villages that did well enough from the wool trade to evolve into something more than a simple confection of pretty houses, oolite stone was used to make just about everything. The columns, quoins, and mullions of the marketplace, the walls and facings of the cottages, the manor house steps and dovecotes, the fonts, the choir stalls, the bell towers and the transept floors of the parish church. In one Cotswold town, Bradford-on-Avon, there's a stone bridge with a stone jailhouse at its centre point, durable, indestructible, and prisoner-proof. The walls between fields, too, are built dry stone, of oolite, and the contrast between a countryside that is apportioned by hedges and its neighbour with its field divided by walls can be blisteringly sudden. In Lincolnshire, where the escarpment of the Lincoln Edge thrusts up with an immediacy reflecting the narrowness of the outcrop there, hedge becomes wall in just a matter of yards. Glance down from the cliff, and every field is surrounded by blackthorn, hornbeam, and dog rose. Glance up from the cliff, and the fields are broken up by long stands of rough and mottled stone, tough, enduring, and very, very old. And yet it is the weathering, more than the simple durability, that provides the magic of the Cotswold oolites. The pale honey coloration of newly cut stone, the rich orange and creamy reds of older, well-weathered buildings, are quite sublime. The rock has given entire villages, Wharton-on-the-Water, Stow-on-the-Wold, Cirencester, Chipping Norton, an architectural wholeness, and it's a fine piece of irony that the poorer, old homes, made of lesser quality stone, have weathered in far more interesting ways than have the great houses built of the finest, unblemished freestone blocks. The patchiness of the weathered yeoman stone seems to give an extra dash of character, an additional element of charm. The Middle Jurassic Great Oolite has given a distinctive look to entire cities, too, a look that is now part of the essence, the quiddity, of their very being. How would the crescents and circuses and terraces of Bath look if they had been constructed of some lesser stone? How much less lovely would Oxford be if the oolitic freestones of so many colleges and noble buildings had not been available, and the structures had been fashioned instead from a dour and ancient granite like the stones of Aberdeen, or from a greyish millstone grit of the north, of Silurian shales and grey slates from Bethesda, or made from a dull red sandstone like that found in unexceptional Middle English cities like Northampton, Doncaster, and Carlisle. The Middle Jurassic limestones make for a building stone of such gentle loveliness that its Cotswold walls, as J.B. Priestley wrote, know the trick of keeping the lost sunlight of centuries glimmering upon them. There is a little more complexity to the oolite than merely to say that the Middle Jurassic, even the outcrop between Bath and Lincolnshire, is composed entirely of it. There are, as William Smith himself found and described early on in his career, at least two types of oolitic limestone represented in the epoch, an inferior oolite at the base of the Middle Jurassic and a great oolite at the top of it. Between the two lies a layer some hundreds of feet thick of a distinctive clay-like rock that, since it had the useful quality when mixed with water of fulling, or leaching the greasy lanolin from lamb's wool, was, as already noted, called fuller's earth. Within the oolitic horizons there are countless variations of colour, grey to buff, orange to ochre to pale scarlet, and fineness of texture, size of oolith, and width of banding and bedding plane. I chanced during my journey upon a roadside quarry near the village of Northleach, and the ebullient owner happily showed me around, pointing out with delighted pride the different colours and thicknesses of his rocks, and the uses he could make of the various types. He used to be a farmer, but he'd given it up back in the 1990s, when he decided there was more money and amusement to be had from working the land below than trying to make ends meet from the land above. He'd become a canny businessman. Build the future was his slogan, use natural stone. He had handsome brochures, tempting customers with warnings, such as the charming thought that lichens would grow on untreated stones, that fragments of shell might protrude from walls and mantels, and that the presence of something called quarry sap might make the more delicate pieces crack in times of severe frost, and advising they be protected with hessian or burlap sacking. He sold oolite by the ton for houses and walls. He also had a small gang of resident masons who slaved away in dusty warehouses, making lintels and fireplaces, finials and corbels, carving gravestones and coats of arms. An admirer of English stone, currently living in Saudi Arabia, had recently ordered a globe, 3 feet in diameter. It would take the quarry owner's chief mason 3 days to finish it, so long as his excavator could delve deep enough among the freestone blocks to find a chunk big enough and free enough of faults to allow for the extraction of a one-ton sphere. What his quarry did not sell, though, was the one lithological expression of the Middle Jurassic that is too rare to market any more, and that is what the quarrymen used to call the pendle, the so-called oolite slate of the Oxfordshire village of Stonesfield, which is not more than a couple of miles from Churchill, where William Smith was born. This rock is not slate at all, but simply a very thin-bedded version of the usual limestone, and it has for centuries been used to finish the roofs of Cotswold houses. A truly classic manor house that one might find between Oxford and Bath should have its walls made of Jurassic freestone, or faced with oolite ashlar, and its roof made of overlapping shingles of Stonesfield slate. The quarry's sap, mentioned in the North Leech brochure, plays a vital part in the making of Stonesfield slate, which, not being a proper slate, cannot be manually split along its bedding planes. Quarrymen would only remove the pendle. They had to mine for this rock, using shafts and burrowing along narrow horizontal tunnels, between October and Christmas, and then leave the rock set in clamps until the onset of the first sharp frost. The moment that this frost came, invariably in the middle of some January night, and the church bells would have to be rung to summon everyone, the miners would dash out to their waiting clamps of pendle and see if the iced-up quarry sap had done its work, shattering the limestone into tile-thin slabs. If it had, then the men spent the summer cutting and shaping the slates, 120,000 of them in one Victorian summer at the Kyneton Thorns pit alone. But if it had not, then the uncracked slabs of pendle would have to be buried in the cold earth to preserve their sap, for if this quarry water was allowed to leach out, it could never return, the rock could never be split, the slates would go unmade, and the men would go unpaid. It was a harsh and unforgiving business. Few are the industries that require frost to keep them in business. The villages of Stonesfield and Colley Weston, unique in the land, came to rely for centuries on the regular onset of bitter cold, just as a Punjabi farmer in India would rely, year after year, on the coming of the monsoon. The quarrymen would have another source of income, though. Fossils were to be found in huge abundance in the Stonesfield slate, not just mollusks and belemnites, the standard fare of the collector and the academic. Here there were pterodactyls, dinosaurs, crocodiles, fish, cirripedes, annelids, starfish, and plants. Each time a quarryman or a slater might find a spectacular occupant, he'd pry it carefully from its limestone resting place and prop it tantalizingly in his cottage window. Geologists from Oxford University nearby, on the hunt for specimens for teaching or research, would know to pass by Stonesfield each weekend, and scores of guineas would change hands for some of the choicer finds. After a pleasing week of wandering along the southern and eastern Midland outcrops of the oolites, and which were invariably garishly covered with the bright yellow flowers of Brassica napus, oilseed rape, which flourishes noticeably well on the limestones with their 6 inches of highly alkaline topsoil, it was time to cross the River Humber, and then watch the Middle Jurassic very nearly vanish. For some while, once I had arrived at Lincoln, where I bought for £30, or $45, a nice varnished specimen of the Liassic ammonite Asterocerus, I had been aware of the looming presence to the east of the uplands of the Cretaceous chalk, the same chalk that William Smith had recognized from 40 miles away that day in 1794, when he climbed up the tower of York Minster. Now the chalk pressed closer and closer, until just outside the Yorkshire village of Market Weighton it lay not, as it should, on an upper Jurassic horizon like Portland Stone or Purbeck beds, but on the Liassic rocks of the lower Jurassic. At Market Weighton there were no Middle Jurassic outcrops at all. Northwards, up to the village of Thixendale, the chalk lay directly either on the Lias, or, for a very few miles, directly on top of the Permian. An entire geological epoch was, in other words, missing, and for no more complicated a reason than that during Middle Jurassic times there was a lozenge-shaped axis of uplifted high ground to the north of Market Weighton, where no waters could lap and inundate, and where no rocks, limestones, shales, cyclothems or milestones could ever possibly accumulate. So for half an hour I drove north through a series of villages that had never known the Middle Jurassic, knew nothing of the Oolites, had few fields of oilseed rape, and that seemed to have been held economic hostage to their geology, after being surrounded on one side by chalk and on the other by clay. The village houses here were uniformly ugly and built of brick. The fields were divided, if at all, only by straggling and ill-kempt bushes. I felt strangely prejudiced against the place, and Smith's diaries showed he hurried through the countryside here too, eager to get back to a part of English geology for which he felt a keen affection, but which here had found no place to settle. North of the villages of Acklam, Levening, and Berrythorpe, the Jurassic returns once more, however, though this time in very different form. Just as with the looming presence of Yorkshire's chalk wolds to the east, so now another clump of hills began to rear darkly in front. These were the North Yorkshire moors, heather-covered and wild, incised by deep valleys and topped by vast flat acreages of unspoiled parkland. But the rocks that make them here are not oolitic limestones, because the seas here were neither shallow nor Hockney blue. This was the delta of an immense river that coursed down from the North Sea Dome, much as the Rhine courses out from Germany near Rotterdam. The rocks here are thick. The river must have been Yangtze vast, and sent billions of tons of sediment into the sea each of the 5 million years of its existence. But the rocks they produce are not limestones. They are sandstones and thick shales, and near the town of Cleveland they are ironstones. There are few marine fossils here, but a huge number of specimens of trees and fossil plants, horsetails, ginkgos, cycads, and even on the Yorkshire coast, very thin bands of coal again. This is the Middle Jurassic still, but as one can tell from the purple billows of heather and the cold and lonely roads snaking past secret military radar stations and up to the cliffs of the North Sea, it's made up of rocks very different from those at the other end of the country. William Smith saw all of this countryside in the first 2 decades of the 19th century. He saw and travelled across and mapped all of this and a great deal more besides. When I followed my own route 200 years later, I did so by dint of using a series of government-issued geological maps, most of them at a scale of 10 miles to the inch, some at 1 mile to the inch, depending on where I was, where I wanted to be, and how much detail I needed to know. And in using those maps I'd realize each day that I pulled them from the car's glove compartment, spread them out before me, and marvelled at their accuracy and their real beauty, that William Smith had, in essence, created them all. He had been the first. It was his labours and his ideas that stood behind the artful confections that now guided me, and that guide a million others today. There is something of a fine irony in the fact that my journey finished where it did, in this remote and enchanting part of North Yorkshire. For in the 1820s William Smith lived and worked here too, mapping and surveying an outcrop of the Middle Jurassic sandstones about 5 miles inland from the coast at a village called Hackness. It was at Hackness that the fortunes that had eluded him for so many long and wretched years finally caught up with him. His life began to turn around, and he could begin afresh. Now, however, with the Jurassic of the Dorset coast hundreds of miles behind me, and with the Jurassic of Yorkshire before me slipping off the cliffs into the cold North Sea, is the moment to pick up the narrative again. To do so, it's necessary to wind back the clock and return to 1802, to the year when William Smith, still young and energetic, and with his later ill fortunes both unanticipated and a very long way off, embarked on what would become the most creative period of his life. The Map That Changed the World. It was a work of genius, and at the same time a lonely and potentially soul-destroying project. It was the work of one man with one idea, bent on the all-encompassing mission of making a geological map of England and Wales. It was unimaginably difficult, physically as well as intellectually. It required tens of thousands of miles of solitary travel, the close study of more than 50,000 square miles of territory that extended from the tip of Devon to the borders of Scotland, from the Welsh marches to the coast of Kent. The task required patience, stoicism, the hide of an elephant, the strength of a thousand, and the stamina of an ox. It required a certain kind of vision, an uncanny ability to imagine a world possessed of an additional fourth dimension, a dimension that lurked beneath the purely visible surface phenomena of the length, breadth, and height of the countryside, and because it had never been seen, was ignored by all customary cartography. To see such a hidden dimension, to imagine and extrapolate it from the little evidence that could be found, required almost a magician's mind, as geologists who are good at this sort of thing know only too well today. And yet, this was as yet a wholly unknown area of imaginative deduction. There were no teachers, no guidebooks, just one man doing it all by himself, imagining the unimaginable. Small wonder that the map of these new underground dimensions took 14 long years to complete, years more than it was supposed to. It proved to be the financial ruin, at least in the short term, of the man who had the vision to see it made. But when it was done, it all proved to be so very good, so revolutionary, so filled with potential for profit and fame, that it was stolen, copied, pirated, and the man who had made it overlooked, ignored, and forgotten for years. When the project was begun at the very start of the 19th century, it was just like so many other vast and ambitious schemes of the time, instilled at first with sunny optimism and good humour. There was an absolute certainty that it would be done, and done very well. And it would indeed be done, and done well, but as it turned out, at what a cost! William Smith, who would come to be known all across the country as the strangely driven and ever-wandering maker of this map, had ended the 18th century with a reputation for scholarship and brio. By the time the 19th century was properly underway, he was fast becoming something rather different, an all-too-familiar, hale and friendly figure in the post-houses and inns along the English stagecoach routes. He was a very talkative man, with all the enthusiasm of the slightly dotty. He chattered so much about the passion for landscape and rocks that drove him that soon he picked up a nickname, Strata Smith, from the barmaids and fellow passengers and those who dined beside him. And though to some he might have been a bit of a bore, he was, by most accounts, well-liked, a bluff and hearty, muscular-looking man, full of energy, restless, talkative, jumpy, untidy, and invariably to be spotted, scurrying hither and yon, always scurrying, and carrying great bundles of papers, maps, and charts under his arm. Maps, indeed, were an abiding passion. Like many uncontrollable passions, they proved a burden, too. Money was a constant trial. When Smith was out working, he had at least 40 maps on the go at once, all of the largest scale and greatest accuracy he could find. And he found his need to have them dismayingly expensive. Because of the time-consuming way maps were engraved in the early 19th century, they were much more costly in relative terms than they are today. And Smith's purchases added very significantly to what he was coming to realize was the inordinately high cost of his own hugely ambitious cartographic enterprise. More trivially, he was to write that the simple business of carrying maps as he bought them, rolled up in tubes, made the practical side of his work very difficult. He was always spotting interesting pieces of rock beside the roadway, always jumping down from the driving seat of the chaise and clambering back up to sit beside the coachman. He had this childlike wish to sit up there in the wind, no matter the weather, the better to see the landscape. But the rolls of maps made this near impossible. To make matters simpler, he carefully cut the larger maps into small squares, bound them into a green Morocco carrying case, and then he was able to write in his diary much later, and quite smugly, that even after travelling thousands of miles with them, the maps were in pretty good preservation, though disfigured in some parts by speculative attempts at the delineation of strata ranging through parts I had not then seen. He must have cut an eccentric figure. People were said to have been frequently rather frightened by him. He was enormously strong-looking and wore a rather stern expression, such that strangers would ask him if he'd ever been a boxer or a soldier. In his journal, he quotes a man remarking to him that he was so damned good-built that it was likely he must have been a great walker in his time, which, given Smith's passion for strolling, clambering, marching, pacing and trolling across countless meadows in search of outcrops, was perhaps only the half of it. He kept himself dressed, ready for the moor, in brown tweeds and with a remarkable broad-brimmed hat, to keep off the sun. This, he wrote later, often prompted dissenters, those religious nonconformists and free thinkers who were flourishing in the fast-changing, fast-industrializing world of the time, to stare at him, thinking he might be one of them, which, given that he was practicing a science dealing in large part with the evidence for and against divine creation, he was most certainly bound to be. The Quakers in particular liked to assume that, from a resemblance in his habiliment, he was a member of their church, and they would wave as he passed. Smith's motive for making a proper geological map of England was more complex than it seems. On one level he was driven by simple intellectual passion. He had discovered in Somerset that the rocks were spread out in historical order, and that their fossils allowed their underground arrangements to be delineated and predicted, and the corollary of these findings was quite obvious to him. He should make a map. He should make it, if for no other reason than that his discoveries now meant that he could. But there were other reasons, too, and these he spelled out from time to time in his writings. He had a deep, obsessively felt need to be given wider recognition for what he was sure were profoundly important discoveries. By the time he ran into the difficulties with John de Brett, and was forced to abandon the book he'd expected de Brett to publish, he was puzzled to find that this recognition was proving to be more elusive than he expected. That the general public was less interested in him and his ideas than he thought they should be bothered him deeply. He wanted to be immortalized. He would become so, he thought, by creating a truly impressive piece of work, one that would last as a memorial for generations. And there was a financial incentive, too. Landowners, among whom his reputation was spreading like bindweed, were set to wondering whether there might be mineral deposits on their estates. Smith, who men like the Duke of Bedford were saying had an uncanny way of predicting what kinds of rocks might lie where, might hold the key to the gentry's further amassment of wealth. Lord Egremont wrote to Smith to inquire if coal was likely to be found on his land at Spofforth. Thomas Jones, a landowner and Member of Parliament in mid-Wales, offered a reward of £500 if he could show where he might find lime on his lands, and others deluged him with letters asking if he suspected there might be lead or tin, flints, clay, marl, or usable sand. And then there was the newly formed Society of Arts, which took the long-term national view. In 1802, at the time when Smith's efforts were getting into high gear, William Shipley's Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce, which, as its name suggests, had been founded to support all manner of worthy schemes, offered a 50-guinea bounty for anyone who might make a mineralogical map of either England, Scotland, or Wales. The Society's leadership knew now that such a thing could be done. It was up to someone, someone with time, energy, knowledge, and, though it was never openly stated, sufficient funds, to take up the challenge and satisfy a demand that was now clearly swelling up from the country's body politic. England wanted a geological map. Rivalry was in the air. The country's cartographers were in the traces. A race was underway. The Society's challenge prompted Smith to lever himself out of his base in the countryside, where, he reasoned, he would win relatively few commercial commissions, and set himself up in an office in town. Accordingly, on the 3rd of April, 1802, he placed an advertisement in the Bath Chronicle announcing his partnership with Jeremiah Cruz, one of the men who had subscribed to his proposed de Brett book, and the subsequent formal opening of the firm of Smith and Cruz Land Surveyors. "Having opened an office at No. 3 Trim Bridge, the corner of Trim Street, Bath, for the purpose of carrying on the above business in all its branches, we take this opportunity of informing the nobility, gentry, and public in general that attendance will be regularly given at the above office, where orders will be thankfully received and executed with accuracy, neatness, and punctuality." He brought his, by now, enormous collection of fossils up from Tucking Mill House and arranged them in their stratigraphical order, at first in boxes on the floor, then on a set of specially constructed sloping shelves. The Duke of Bedford came down to see them, and so did the Duke's land steward, John Ferry. And although Messrs. Smith and Cruz was not to be an entirely successful firm, Smith resigned from the partnership early in 1804, its existence consolidated his friendship with Ferry, who was to become one of the most conscientious supporters, both of Smith himself and of the map he was set upon making. In John Ferry he could not have had a sturdier ally, although the relationship did get off to a rocky start. Ferry's initial career as the Duke's land steward had been hatched mainly because he had been born on the Woburn estate, where his father had a tenant farm. But the young man's interests were in fact wider and more Catholic by far than those of a typical ducal employee. He soon left Woburn, sacked by an incoming duke, became an expert musician and a chorister of note, a mathematician whose work, on the curious properties of vulgar fractions, is still known today, as well as a contributor to encyclopedias on such topics as astronomy, engineering, the history of pacifism, the design of steam engines, the decimalization of currencies, and the population theories of Thomas Malthus. He was also hugely interested in and stimulated by Smith, and travelled with him frequently as a devoted acolyte and apprentice in those early years of the century, learning theories and techniques that he was eventually to put to good use on his own account. Rather too good, Smith was eventually to complain bitterly, in an incident that illustrates the growing problems, some real, others merely the consequence of his perception, that were beginning to cloud William Smith's life. The falling out between Smith and Ferry began when the editors of Abraham Rees's New Cyclopaedia turned to the highly literate Ferry, and not to Smith, when they wanted articles to illustrate words and concepts of geology, such as clay strata, coal, colliery, and extraneous fossils. The choice greatly injured Smith's self-esteem, even though Ferry was at pains to make generous mention in each article of his mentor's name, his achievements, and his theories. But when Smith found out that the entry on canal had been cut back by the editors so as to exclude the entire account of his own contribution to the building of the Somerset Coal Canal, he was cut to the quick. And then again, when shortly afterwards Ferry wrote to say that he had been asked by the National Board of Agriculture to prepare a survey of the county of Derbyshire, and was writing to ask whether to save time he might see Smith's own drawings of the strata there, so that he could trace them onto his own map, Smith became incandescent with rage. No, he fumed, Ferry could most certainly not see the map. If he wanted to survey Derbyshire, then he could do it himself, no matter how long it might take. And in any case, his letter continued, he, Smith, should have been the one asked by the board, not this scientific pilferer, as John Ferry, now a turncoat, had in his eyes become. It was a brief enough tiff, though. The men were the best of friends once again soon after, with Ferry ending up as the most loyal of Smith's many supporters. But at the same time, the argument shows once again the degree to which Smith felt he was being overlooked and shunned by those in society who were reckoned to be more gentlemanly than himself. The Board of Agriculture, for example, was composed of grand landowning men. Their president, Sir John Sinclair, though ostensibly a friend of Smith's, was an indefatigable Scottish aristocrat, a man of vast wealth, who had raised his own regiment, the Rothsay and Caithness Fencibles, had become a world-class expert on sheep, and was interested enough in numbers to introduce the word statistics into the English language. That so august a figure should apparently overlook in his choice for a county survey a member of the Oxfordshire peasantry, and give the task instead to an apparently learned man working on a duke's estate, was perhaps not all that surprising in the class-ridden days of the early 19th century. But to Smith it was a considerable slight, of a kind to which he would never truly become accustomed. In the case of his relations with John Ferry, though, the situation was later helped when Ferry, too, was to feel the crushing weight of English snobbery, most notably by being denied membership of the newly formed Geological Society, because he was merely the son of a farmer. In later years, both Ferry and Smith clung together in their mutually held opposition to what they saw as the lofty hauteur of the gentleman rock collectors. So close was their relationship in those early days that Ferry came to be regarded by friends as Smith's Boswell, a chronicler and lifelong advocate of all his master's works. It was at about this time, too, that Ferry introduced to William Smith the one figure of great national repute who was going to be singularly important in the making of the great map, and the man who was to figure prominently in this growing dispute between the practical and the gentlemanly students of earth science. For Smith was not alone in regarding himself as a victim caught in the crossfire of British class warfare. The entire and newly fashionable discipline of geology was about to be riven by arguments between the horny-handed toilers in the fields and the more fragrant dilettante practitioners, between amateurs who specialized in studying the land below and those regarded by the former as worthless dandies whose interest was more in owning and exploiting the land above. The man who would try to mediate this dispute, and who would at first do his level best to accelerate Smith's progress in making his new map, was the then president of London's distinguished Royal Society, the influential and far-seeing botanist Sir Joseph Banks. Banks, after whom an Australian flower is named, and whose reputation in New South Wales, of which he was a principal founder, is huge, is perhaps best known for being the moving force behind the notorious Bounty Expedition of 1789, which culminated in Fletcher Christian's mutiny against Captain William Bligh and his subsequent establishment of a settlement on Pitcairn Island. Banks was not known to be especially interested in geology, other than being remarkably impressed by the columnar basalts of Fingal's Cave on the Hebridean islet of Staffa, until he came into the ownership of a Derbyshire estate, Overton, near Ashover, that had valuable lead deposits. But the lead mines were running out. Overton's famous Gregory mine, which had once turned an annual £100,000 profit, was now suffering losses of £23,000 a year. When Sir Joseph borrowed John Ferry from Woburn in 1797 to help drain his Derbyshire land, he mentioned his problem with the lead. At first there was nothing Ferry could do. He wasn't very interested in geology himself, and he didn't know anyone who was. But then he met William Smith at that great agricultural gathering known as the Woburn Sheep Shearing. He learned about Smith's planned book, outlining the new principles of stratigraphy, which at that point John de Brett still seemed keen to publish. Smith, Ferry felt sure, would be just the right person, and he explained this to Banks. If anyone could predict whether more lead might be discovered at Overton, it would be William Smith. Banks was delighted with the encounter, which appears to have first come about in the summer of 1801. That at least was when it was first known, from John Phillips's later biography, that Sir Joseph favoured Smith with an interview, and from this time until his death in 1820 remained a steady friend and liberal patron of his labours. Ferry encouraged Banks to help. In February 1802, after taking an expedition with Smith and another of Smith's pupils named Benjamin Bevan, he wrote a long letter to Overton, insisting that Smith's findings were of paramount importance. He explained to Sir Joseph, patiently but from the tone of his letter not at all condescendingly, that he believed Smith had made two great advances. He was able to document the sequential order of British rocks, and he was able to identify the rocks that made up the sequences by examining the fossils found within them. Smith, to put it more simply, could both tell where rocks were and what they were, and, by dint of an energetic and systematic program of observing, surveying, measuring, and marking, he could draw, as indeed he was now in the middle of drawing, a proper, detailed, and accurate geological map of the nation. Sir Joseph took the bait. Smith first noted the likelihood of winning the great man's support, support that would prove invaluable if it came, when he wrote in May 1802 to a friend from his office in Bath, "I have been obliged to have recourse to an uninterrupted pursuit of my subject, with all my plans and papers together here, and I shall call on Sir J. Banks in London to settle about bringing my papers before the public in much better form than if they had appeared last year. I am now confident they are correct, and my map begins to be a very interesting history of the country." By the following month, a new map, not much better than the first small-scale attempt he had made in 1801, presumably, was beginning to take shape, and he felt confident enough to show a version of it to Sir Joseph at the Woburn Agricultural Meeting. The agricultural magazine for the month reports the fact dryly. "Smith exhibited his map, now in very considerable forwardness, of the strata of different earths, stones, coal, and which constitute the soil of this island. He was particularly noticed by Sir J. Banks. The following October, Smith wrote to Banks at his country house in Lincolnshire to bring him up to date, and then again in spring, all this according to his journal, which he was now writing at a furious rate, he took the latest version up to London, to show it off to Banks in the Royal Society suite at Somerset House, off the Strand. The encounter was a small triumph of assurance and optimism. Banks would support a subscription for the new publication, and wrote a cheque for £50 to get the project off the ground. As he left his great new patron's chambers, Smith must have felt that he now had every reason to believe he had won the support and the enthusiastic backing of the most powerful figure in British science. If he had until this moment, from time to time, felt overlooked and wronged, then at this juncture in his career he had precious little cause to do so. Later on, when Banks became increasingly exasperated with him, he might have some cause, but not now. Just now he could savour the sweet smell of impending success. As it happened, though, the Somerset House meeting, which took place on April the 21st, 1803, turned out to be rather less propitious than Smith's delighted diary entry might make it seem, because it laid Smith open to a temptation to which he should not have succumbed. It seduced him into taking an apartment in London. It was a woefully imprudent decision. Smith was not a well-off man. It had now been nearly 10 years since he had been in full-time employment, and although he was being paid handsomely enough for his work as a drainer or mineral surveyor, the work was typical of the freelance trade, days of feast followed by weeks of famine. And in between the episodes of paid work, he had to continue his journeying to make his endless geological surveys, journeying by stagecoach, for a not inconsiderable fee, lodging at coaching inns for substantial sums, wolfing down pigeon pie and porter, and the big breakfasts that his energies demanded. He asked the Society of Arts if they might help him with an occasional supply of funds. They apparently turned him down, as did all too many others whom he approached. And now he was embarking on a programme to spend even more. He had an office back in Bath to run, a partner, the long-forgotten Jeremiah Cruise, to pay, and an estate in Tucking Mill to keep, with its stable and garden, and a manservant on constant hand. On the face of it, Smith was heading into deep financial waters, and yet, at precisely the time when he should have been trying to keep his expenses down, he was suddenly seduced, presumably by the magnificence of Sir Joseph's own grace and favour lodgings off the Strand, to take with effect from that same April day a permanent and costly lodging place just around the corner, at number 16 Charing Cross. He rented rooms there from a Mr. Tapster. The building was called Tapster's Baths. He shared it with his landlord and with one Francis Place, a mysterious man described in the DNB as a tailor and radical reformer. The accommodation, though expensive, was small. Smith spent most of his London days at the Craven Coffee House close by, which he used almost as an office. His initial plan was to engage an assistant who could stay in the Tapster's Baths rooms during the day and begin work on designing the final version of his map, as well as starting a programme for drawing all of his fossils. But for the time being he decided to leave his actual collection behind in Bath at the offices on Trim Bridge. It turned out to be one of the very few prudent decisions he was to make during this frantic period in his life. It was just as well that he never brought his fossils to town, for just a few months after he had moved in, and as a harbinger of other disasters to come, his building, and the one next to it, caught fire and burned to the ground. Smith's assistant, who would almost certainly not have been able to carry hundreds of pounds of boxes of precious samples out of a blazing house, managed to save most of his papers. They were removed in a hurry and in disorder, according to John Phillips, but at least they were safe. Smith was in any case not there. Once again he had been afflicted by his persistent wanderlust, and when his house burned down he was out of the city on yet another map-making field excursion. The fire did not deter him from his grand plan to have an address in London. Quite the reverse. He now took an even larger establishment, an entire five-storied mansion at No. 15 Buckingham Street in the Adelphi, an impeccably sited house, standing beside the Thames, beautifully designed, conveniently located both for the Society of Arts and for Sir Joseph Banks's office at the Royal Society. He paid a rent of 80 guineas a year, far too much for a man with such slender resources, with rent to pay in Trimbridge, a mortgage to pay on Tucking Mill, and with a wildly varying income. And he added to his bills a further pound a month for a housekeeper, the charmingly named Mrs. Kitten. A house in the Adelphi development was indeed a wonderful place for a man of means to live. The Adam brothers had designed them, and imported Scottish labourers, kept content by having bagpipes played to them, had built them. The houses, which went up on the site of the old riverside mansion of Durham House, immediately upriver from Somerset House, were spacious and elegant and known by the clever honeysuckle motif on their stucco frontings. But the development wasn't a success, and the brothers only avoided bankruptcy by selling them off at bargain prices in a lottery. Not that Smith had the money to buy. For all his sojourn in Buckingham Street, he was obliged to rent. Smith liked the place enormously, so much so that in late 1804, after the Duke of Bedford had made an inspection tour of his fossils down in Bath, he had all his specimens moved up to London, thousands of them, wrapped in paper or in small packets, and by now displaying no fewer than 720 different species. As with the scholar whose home is considered to be wherever his library stood, so it was with William Smith and his collection. This is where his fossils would lodge from now on. It was to be his official residence, a suitably grandiose symbol of the work in which he was now engaged. "I'm happy to inform you that my fossils are now safely arrived in London," he wrote to a friend in South Wales in June 1805, "and are now arranged in the same order as they lay in the earth." He rather liked the notion, erroneous as it happens, that Peter the Great of Russia had stayed at No. 15 when making his celebrated tour of England in 1698, and he would have thought it eminently suitable that the young Charles Dickens lodged there in 1833, by which time it had been converted into flats. But when he was there alone, except for Mrs. Kitten, he sported none of the trappings suitable either for a Romanov emperor or a writer of great fame. Inside the house, everything was modest to the point of monasticism. He was becoming fearful, evidently, of the possible financial consequences of yet more extravagance. In later, wiser times, when he experimented with an autobiography, he was to write, "In London a tax-gatherer, of one denomination or other, is never long absent from your door. With their heavy hands my old rusty knocker too often made my high old house echo to the attics. I might have reduced taxes by stopping up windows, and indeed by shutting up useless rooms. But it was only a house of call for me on my way through London, and a depot for my fossils. For I had no time to devote to the economy and comforts of housekeeping. I never half furnished it, never had a dining-table. No carpets crossed my old oak floors, no rich curtains darkened my windows. And though my rent was high, I had no expensive living, no dinner-parties, no wine-merchants to pay." He had indeed no time to devote to the comforts of housekeeping. His travel diary for the years between taking up residence in Buckingham Street in 1804 and in 1812 making his first real breakthrough in the publication of his map reads like that of a fury. His business as a drainer kept him travelling incessantly between Norfolk and Kent, between outposts in Wales and northern Yorkshire. The owners of Hickling Marshes, for instance, had him stopping inundations from the sea between Yarmouth and Happisburg. He was asked to go to Dolly Mellin Thwin, near Dalgethley in North Wales, to look at the slate quarries and inspect the soundness of a new embankment. He went to the top of Snowdon, the highest mountain south of the Scottish border. He examined the copper mines near Llanberis. We find his diary telling us he's variously in Yorkshire, Lancashire, Somerset, Gloucester, Devon, Rutland, Nottingham. Here he is opening a coal mine at Torbock near Liverpool. Here he is directing a trial boring at Spofforth. There he is off looking at the cliffs of Witton Fell in Yorkshire. He examined coal outcrops at Newent, at Nailsea, and in the Forest of Dean. He built a series of sand-dune-mimicking embankments, all shells and marram grass, to help protect the South Welsh coast from flooding at Loch Arn. He worked on planning another big canal, the Ouse Navigation in Sussex. He was called in to help because the Kennet and Avon Canal, in his old stamping ground near Bath, had sprung a leak. A landowner in Buckinghamshire tried to find coal on his land and called in Smith, who put down some bores and told him he was wasting his time. Scores of other would-be coal millionaires demanded his time, which he willingly gave for his customary 2 or 3 daily guineas, if only to prove the pointlessness of their hopes. He was persuaded, despite offering the advice that owners were squandering their money, to conduct a survey in Herefordshire, another near Wincanton, and a third within sight of the towers of the Oxford Colleges at Bagley Wood, knowing on each of these occasions, as no other person in Britain possibly could know, that there was as much chance of discovering coal as there was of striking gold. It came as a pleasant diversion when he was asked to perform a task that would not end in disappointment, as when he planned a series of improvements to the harbour at Kidwelly, a little Welsh port well known to later readers of Dylan Thomas, or when he completed works on the Minsmere drainage scheme in deepest Sussex. Occasionally there were more amusing or rewarding tasks, which brought him more than the simple per diem fee. In 1810, for instance, the Bath Corporation called him in because of an unparalleled calamity. The hot springs, which had provided the town with a raison d'etre since before Roman times, suddenly failed, and no one knew why. No one knew why, in fact, there were hot springs in Bath anyway, considering the city's location on top of thousands of feet of congenially stable sediments, with not a volcanic fissure in sight. Smith rushed from London to the Bath pump room, examined the situation, and declared that the only way he could find out the reason for the failure was to dig a bore into the very spring itself. The city fathers were appalled. Never had an excavation been performed in these most hallowed buildings. But in the end, faced with the prospect of a well gone dry, they reluctantly agreed, and William Smith and a gang of navvies, hired by the day, burrowed down through the familiar limestones and clays of the Middle Jurassic, until, after suffering in temperatures of 119 degrees Fahrenheit, and melting all the candles they had used to light their way, they found the problem. It was all the fault of the large bone of a great ox, or, as the official city report of the time put it, some large ruminant. Somehow the bone had fallen into the spring, had become crystallized with pyrite and flint, and had rolled itself into the channel and blocked it. The waters promptly made another channel for themselves, as waters like to do, and flowed out into the Avon somewhere else. A few of the more suspicious members of the corporation said it was all really the fault of a new coal mine that was being dug at the time 3 miles away at Bath Easton, and there was a very angry movement to have this mine stopped up to protect the integrity of the springs. But Smith went to Bath Easton to have a look and decided that the two weren't connected in any way. Bath's hot springs had failed because of a pyritized oxbone and nothing else. He removed it. The hot and healing and vile-tasting waters began to flow again with greater vigour than before, and Smith became, just as he liked, the hero of the hour. And for good measure, he went and plugged the hole in the coal mine as well. Much the same happened when he drained the infamous Prisley Bog on the Duke of Bedford's estate at Woburn. This he managed with such speed and ingenuity, and moreover published a brief monograph in 1806 on how he had done it, that the Society of Arts awarded him a medal. He was naturally delighted, except that it gave him good reason to remember, since this was the same society that was offering a premium for making a great map, that the years were ticking on, and still nothing had been published. Sir Joseph Banks was also beginning to wonder why his golden boy had not yet delivered. It was now 5 years since the men had first met, and since the day John Ferry had told Sir Joseph, with some prescience seen in today's light, what a stellar figure Smith was destined to be. Banks had already contributed the sizeable, but for him quite easily affordable, £50. He had persuaded dozens of his friends and acquaintances to subscribe to the impending publication. He had seen Smith at least 3 further times, at the 1804 Woburn sheep shearing, at the Smithfield cattle show 6 months later, and then in London early in January 1805. There had been much talk of the map, soon to be exhibited for the information of the curious, according to an optimistic publisher's notice in the newspapers in Banks's very own London library. But since then there had been nothing, and influential men were beginning to grow impatient, exasperated. Smith had been expected both to prepare a great map and to continue work on the treatise on strata that Debrett had been hoping to publish, but neither book nor map showed the slightest sign of being readied for an appearance, even in rough draft. Richard Crawshay, a Welsh landowner who had been an early supporter and who had promised money, wrote sharply about this to Smith in February 1806. "I'm sorry to find that your promise of and my reliance on you for a publication of great importance is totally vanished. You will excuse my interfering any further in your affairs. I wish you well." It was a considered and stunning insult. Smith wrote a spluttering explanation, but Crawshay never replied. Even the tolerant old Sir Joseph was worried. He wrote Fairy to the effect that he did not feel himself so interested in encouraging any new work of Smith's. Other potential subscribers were holding back too, worried that Smith might never complete his work. They knew that he travelled widely, that he worked furiously, that he constantly promised visible progress. But nothing emerged. Nothing from the Adelphi, nothing from Trimbridge, nothing from Tucking Mill House. It was, for Smith, a terrible time. His book on draining had brought in no money. His most loyal supporter, John Fairy, had been appointed, rather than Smith, to make an official survey of Derbyshire. It seemed suddenly as though there might be a conspiracy waged against him, a sudden drying up of commissions, the beginnings of a muttering campaign. He had fallen out with the assistant at Buckingham Street, a man named Roop, whom Smith now described as a book-learned, paragraph-writing coxcomb, a remark that was about as rude as one could be in the London of the day without risking a duel. Then there had been an innovative suggestion from Sir John Sinclair, the president of the Board of Agriculture, that Smith might become associated with army engineers, might organise them into a map-making organisation, like the one that was eventually to be created, the Ordnance Survey. But Smith was not interested, or the board not interested in him, and a once exciting-sounding project that would have been ideal for Smith eventually came to naught. But most significantly hurtful of all, there came the formal foundation, in 1807, of a new and vitally important London Learned Association, the Geological Society, and with it the wounding realisation that despite all his evident contribution to the new science, William Smith had pointedly not been invited to join. The impact of that decision was to rumble thunderously down the years, and it was to culminate, as we shall see, in the most delicious of ironies. But for the moment, in 1807, the news, when it was transmitted to Buckingham Street by friends, must have made it seem to Smith as if the whole basis of his professional existence was being lost. His personal life, too, seemed suddenly to be spiralling out of control. He was so short of funds that he began to consider selling his property to keep himself afloat. What little land he still had left from his family back in Oxfordshire had already gone. The Trimbridge offices were now gone, rented to another tenant. All that remained that he could call his own was his mortgaged home at Tucking Mill. But try as he might, it wouldn't sell, and the owner of the mortgage, Charles Connolly of Midford Castle, was making it abundantly clear to Smith that he would not release him from the mortgage debt or buy back the house himself. It was at about this time in Smith's life that he made what appears to have been another woefully bad decision, and that was to get married. A sensible and ordered marriage might, of course, have been a good thing, but from all the available evidence, and there's very little, much seems to have been destroyed, and perhaps deliberately, it seems that his union was anything but sensible and ordered. We know little about his wife other than her name, Mary Ann. No records have so far come to light about her origins, except for the assumption, calculated from her death record, that she had been born in 1791 or 1792, or of the date of the wedding, or when, since it seems unlikely that there was, in fact, any ceremonial, the two became formally married. Everything that can be deduced stems from the fact that his diary for the year 1808 is missing, and that there are occasional references to M.A. in the journals for many of the years that follow. The first mention of what is probably her comes in a diary entry written in August 1809. Smith was in Norfolk, from where he wrote a note in faint pencil, said per M.A., letter to come away Tuesday evening. and did indeed arrive on that day, apparently telling his wife to expect him. On September the 26th, he records paying Mrs. K 2 months' wages, £2, M.A., £2. In April 1811, he notes that he wrote a letter to M.A. from Bath. In December 1815, more ominously, at home all day with M.A., taken ill with a pain in the head. In 1815, if her birth date is correct, Mary Ann Smith would have been 24, and yet already perhaps 7 years married. Smith seems to have started to live with her, almost certainly married, when she was only 17, and by such accounts as exist, it was a terrible marriage, with his wife neither educated nor stable enough, following the 1815 headaches which began to worsen and transmute into more sinister ailments, to have been much of a support during these grim years. Indeed, Mary Ann seems to have been little more than a burden to Smith for most of his life. Her death, which happened some long time after that of her husband, came about in the very saddest of circumstances. During her life she fell victim to all manner of illnesses, physical and mental. Her case notes, kept in an asylum where she was later lodged, record her as having suffered from many things, not least the pathological need for sexual intercourse that is a common enough side effect of some of the more florid mental illnesses, and which was known then, as it still is now, as nymphomania. Meanwhile, Smith continued to try to have something, anything, published. He got it into his head the notion that he might write a short description of Norfolk, a county whose geology he knew well, and he took advantage of a parliamentary election campaign in Norwich to circulate among the crowds of voters, offering them cards advertising the forthcoming book, and talking up the impending publication of his greater works. But the Norfolk booklet or map never appeared either. Smith was losing his sense of self-esteem and self-worth, suddenly reckoning himself a presumptuous intruder into the learned world, remembering that he was merely a yeoman and an orphan. "I could previously write some sentences very well," he was to reminisce as an excuse, "but never with sufficient confidence, and I often found a difficulty in carrying on properly the continuity of a subject." And so those nightmare years continued, from 1806 until 1812, 6 miserable years when nothing seemed to go right for him, when his friends were beginning to desert him, and when his muse had apparently fled, his money was trickling away at an alarming rate, and the only thing he knew how to do was to travel, take samples, make notes, and cram into his grizzled head more and ever more information about the underside of England. It fascinated and drove him still, but there seemed no future in it for him or his supporters, his allies, and his backers. Old Dr. Richard Warner of Bath chose this time, most inappositely, to publish a guide to the city and its surroundings, making ample use of the geological information provided by his neighbour Smith, and to which he had referred generously when he wrote a Bath history 10 years before. But on this occasion, in 1811, he stole freely from his one-time friend, drew a map that was an almost exact copy of one of Smith's earlier experiments, and made no acknowledgement of him at all, another example of the plagiarising and pilfering to which the poor stratigrapher was having to become accustomed. But then one old friend did eventually prove to be true. The Reverend Joseph Townsend, in whose house Smith had originally dictated his famous Table of Strata, published a book in 1812 with the curious title The Character of Moses Established, which set out to prove scientifically that the Mosaic view of the world's creation, in which, of course, the flood, the deluge, figured prominently, was still the right one. No matter the prelate's clouded scientific vision, the important feature of Moses is that it included, at length and in great detail, the essence of William Smith's work. It showed Smith to have a unique vision of the underside of the earth. It gave Smith all the credit that had been due, and because Townsend was a well-known and well-respected man, it placed William Smith firmly back in the minds of the nation's chattering classes. And whether it was because of this book, or merely coincident with its publication, one key figure in this story suddenly and enthusiastically and unexpectedly came back into the Smith's life. John Carey, the country's foremost cartographer, announced that he would print and publish William Smith's great map. The two men had met some 20 years before, when Smith was working on the survey of the coal canal in Somerset. Now, without warning, this distinguished mapmaker suddenly agreed to come on board, a move that everyone knew would now guarantee that this extraordinarily ambitious work would at last see the light of day. Why Carey agreed, no one knows. It's convenient to assume, however, that he came across Townsend's curious book and was impressed by the evident importance of a man who he remembered well from their canal-making days. Yet the reasons matter much less than the outcome. In the blink of an eye, Smith's fortunes were changed, and on this singular occasion, very much for the better. The first task was for Carey, working at his offices at 181 Strand, to make a wholly new topographic map of England and Wales. On this, William Smith, who was working nearby on the floor of his main dining room at 15 Buckingham Street, would superimpose his geological information, information that he had now spent more than 15 years and hundreds of thousands of lonely miles accumulating. Smith decreed from the start that the scale should be 5 miles to the inch, meaning that the map itself, if fitted up as one sheet, would measure 105 inches by 74, or 8 foot 9 inches high by 6 foot 2 inches across. Smith had no doubts at all. What he was making was going to be mightily impressive. It was going to be a grand map, big, eye-catching, memorable, and entirely appropriate to the majesty of the topic that it would picture. It was, after all, the first ever map of the geology of an entire country, and not just a country, but the most important kingdom, as Britain then saw herself, on the face of the civilized planet. There was no other such map of an entire country anywhere in existence. What was now being created in London was to be the model that the rest of the nations would have to follow. This map was to be a world leader in every conceivable way, and it was to look magnificent too, so that no one would ever have cause or occasion to doubt its excellence. Carey performed the outline drawing. One of Smith's lawyer friends, Henry Jermyn, of the ancient Cistercian Abbey at Sibton in Suffolk, was chosen to help perform the engraving, which included the writing of place names, numbering in the thousands. It was evidently a pleasurable time. "I have a copy of Carey's map spread out on the carpet," wrote Smith. "He turned to his valuable collection of old authors, and thus did we proceed in marking the names. In those gleams of light thrown on the dark pages of our history, we had many pleasant discussions." The task was performed with infinite care, and yet at a rollicking pace. By February 1813, of the 16 copper plates on which the topographical map was being engraved, 3 had already been finished. A year later, and the remaining 13 were done, and Smith could now begin the equally painstaking task of colouring the individual strata, the key ingredient of a geological map. As he explained in his diary on the day he started, it was his wish to render the map as interesting as possible to those who are desirous of knowing all they can of their country. He now knew by heart, from all his years of travelling, the geology of a handsome proportion of England's secondary rocks. His knowledge of the Jurassic, for example, provided him with a core of stratigraphical information that allowed him to colour in lines of strata from the south coast of Dorset to the east coast of Yorkshire. He could provide a swathe of information that more than justified his ambition to create a map of the whole country. His time in Norfolk had allowed him to add details of the Cretaceous, too. To the oolites and clays of the Jurassic, he could now add his new and formidable knowledge of the chalk, a rock which, together with the honey-hued limestones of the Cotswolds, is perhaps the country's most distinctive outcrop, a potent symbol, no less, in the white cliffs of Dover, of the insular nature of the island kingdom. On April the 18th, 1814, Smith was interested indeed when he passed Carey's shop in the Strand and saw that in the bow windows of the store were 4 of his sheets, completely finished and fully coloured. Carey had chosen to surprise and delight the 45-year-old mapmaker. He had placed the finished sheets, which included sheet 11, the area round Bath, in the window without telling anyone. Smith, who became as excited as a schoolboy, snatched up the sheets and immediately, his first reaction, and a noble one, took them over to Somerset House to show to Sir Joseph Banks. Sir Joseph had, after all, been the project's first supporter. He had given Smith £50 to begin the subscription, And yes, maybe he had harumphed with exasperated impatience 8 years before, when there seemed no end to the project in sight, but now all was coming to fruition, and, Smith reasoned, banks should and would, especially as a near neighbour, be the first to see the finished sheets. If he agreed, then he would be named on the completed full-scale map as the one person to whom the entire project had been dedicated, the person to whom Smith owed most of all. Banks agreed readily, for the map, he declared, was a most handsome thing. He would tell his friends, urge them to offer their support even at this late stage. And so it came 6 weeks later in June, and William Smith was being summoned by no less a figure than Lord Hardwick to present the completed sheets to the leaders of the Board of Agriculture. They agreed wholeheartedly with Sir Joseph. The map was already magnificent, and once finished, excellent in every way. Smith was told to make sure that he send a prospectus for the map to every member, and he promptly wrote as polite a solicitation as could be imagined, indicating that William Smith will explain the subject of the strata at his house, 15 Buckingham Street, the Strand, on this and the following days, between the hours of 11 and 5, to such gentlemen as choose to subscribe towards the publication of this great national work. W. Smith's Discoveries of Regularities in the Strata, with their accompanying organic remains, will be illustrated with engravings of his large collection of fossils, which are placed in the same order as they lay in the earth. Implicit in this letter was a powerful sales pitch. Everyone who could buy one of these maps, an example of, as purchasers were not allowed to forget, this great national work, should now sign up to do so. It mattered little how much people could afford. There was, as John Carey had decreed, a convenient spectrum of tariffs. All depended on whether the buyer preferred the keenly priced edition, with the 16 unmounted paper sheets, and a memoir all bound up in a box of stiff blue board for £5, whether he opted for the standard full-size canvas-mounted map, ready for placing on a wall and which would set him back £7, or whether he decided to splash out and buy the deluxe version, the edition that was offered on canvas, mounted, varnished, set on spring rollers and issued with a fitted leather carrying case, for which the price was the not inconsiderable sum of £12. Carey and Smith were open to all kinds of financial models, and William Smith reckoned, with Carey's implicit agreement, that he should make about 25 shillings on every copy sold. 10 months later, and all was quite ready. On March 15, 1815, we have him writing in his journal that he had finished corrections of 5 western sheets of the map, which now completes the general corrections required. It remained only for 3 crowning moments. The first came in mid-March, 1815, when the Prime Minister himself, the great reactionary figure of Lord Liverpool, came to Buckingham Street to inspect the immense map. He pronounced himself well pleased and congratulated Smith. That, considering Smith's background, was no small feat indeed. The second came later that spring in May, when Smith went to the Society of Arts and formally presented to its president, the Duke of Norfolk, the completed map for inspection. Smith, stony broke as always, was at this time only too well aware that 13 years beforehand the Society had offered a prize of 50 guineas for the first mineralogical map of the nation. He was eager that the Society should now inspect his work and decide whether to pay up. They did, 2 weeks later. Smith records the moment matter-of-factly in his diary entry for the 16th of June. Received from Dr. Taylor, Secretary to the Society of Arts, their premium of £52.10 for my mineralogical map of England. Guineas, the money of the upper classes, clearly did nothing for Smith. And then the third crowding moment, which came on August 1, 1815, the official date for the formal publication of the map, its distribution to those who had subscribed, its offering to bookshops around the land. The colouring was all done and dried, all copies were now numbered and signed, and in most cases had been coloured by the hand of William Smith. It was then, and it remains now, a truly magnificent thing, huge, beautiful, and filled with absorbing and elegantly managed detail. And when it's compared with modern maps of the geology of the country, in the very broadest sense, it can be seen to be uncannily right. It's also, as well as being a scientific document without peer, tremendously attractive as a piece of art. It is highly coloured in a way that mimics the colours of the rocks below, so that one can almost imagine that Smith was painting a portrait of the country, with all the foliage and topsoil stripped from it, such that only the rocks remain. Green for the chalk, blue for the lias, and a honey-coloured, orange-hued, bright streak of evening sunshine for the outcrop of the Middle Jurassic that he loved so much. The map is entitled with suitable grandiloquence: A Delineation of the Strata of England and Wales with Part of Scotland, exhibiting the collieries and mines, the marshes and fenlands originally overflowed by the sea, and the varieties of soil according to the variations in the substrata, illustrated by the most descriptive names. And there is the dedication, too, as promised, to the man who stood by him, impatiently betimes, but who had stood true until the end, to the Right Honourable Sir Joseph Banks, Baronet, Fellow of the Royal Society. This map is by permission most respectfully dedicated by his much obliged servant, W. Smith. And there is the date, August the 1st, 1815, as John Phillips, his nephew and first biographer, was to write of Smith: "From that hour the fame of its author as a great original discoverer in English geology was secured." 400 copies of the map were printed, numbered and signed. About 40 of them are known to remain in existence today. Collectors regard them as valuable beyond price. Huge sums are commanded for those very few copies that come onto the market. They are renowned within the rarefied world of the map dealer. There are several copies in London. One of the finest is the one that hangs behind the sky-blue velvet curtains beside the main staircase of the Geological Society of London in Burlington House, Piccadilly. The curtains make for a concealment that abets a kind of shame. For considering what happened next, and considering how members of the Geological Society of the day dealt so cruelly with this man who had created so magnificent a testament to the science they were following, it's remarkable that the map is permitted in the building at all. It is in a way a haunting reminder, rarely seen now, of the way in which scientists, and especially British scientists of an era long past, behaved quite unforgivably towards one who was so self-evidently not one of their own.